Due to the graphic nature of some of the content in this episode, listener discretion is advised.
Hey.
Yo, what's up?
How you doing?
Is now a good time to talk?
Yeah, sure.
So I just talked to the mother-in-law over the phone.
March 8th, 2006, on the front page of the Mooresville Tribune, above an article detailing the town's local art crawl, there's a candid, now haunting photo of a young family, a husband, wife, and their two small daughters, seen casually admiring artwork on the walls inside an old train depot in the heart of downtown Mooresville, North Carolina. Long ago, a hub of transportation for the region, the depot has since been repurposed into an art gallery, an heirloom from a bygone era when life moved a bit slower and textile mills still drove the local economy. But time has a way of changing things, and in the last half century, with the filling of Lake Norman and the Charlotte banking boom, this once small bucolic town has transformed at record speed into a thriving modern suburb with lakeside mansions and sprawling shopping centers. Mooresville today towers over its small-town past. And at the height of this new growth, in 2009, when the town's population spiked 50%, Mooresville unwillingly became home to one of the most awful and bizarre crimes the region has ever known. Matt Stewart, that young father on the front page of the paper, was a man a lot like his hometown. Humble and good-willed, wise beyond his years, but full of energy and hope. With a promising career in nursing at the local hospital and a young family just getting started, Matt's future was stolen in the early hours of June 9th, 2009, when a shadowy figure appeared in his bedroom doorway and began opening fire on him and his wife, Angel, as they slept in bed with their one-year-old son. In a barrage of gunfire and struggle that went unheard by neighbors and houses just yards away, Matt Stewart was shot and stabbed to death in his own home. That morning, as blue lights shot silently across the rooftops along Shepherd's Hill Drive, that shadowy figure in the doorway seemingly vanished as quickly and mysteriously as he appeared, leaving behind an immense grief that has festered in this community for the last decade, and a mystery with the truth still worth chasing. My name is Freddie, and this is Unforgotten, a podcast series that lingers in the recent past, haunting the conscience of those who know more about the unsolved murder of Matt Stewart.
Back in June, a husband and a wife were asleep in their upstairs bedroom here when a stranger came in, brutally attacked, and killed the husband.
It was personal.
Why isn't he dead in the bed?
I've been lied to about this from the beginning.
No one heard gunshots.
No one heard gunshots.
They may know who did it. They may know exactly.
Why would you say that to a podcaster?
The mattress was covered in blood.
I started this podcast to break through the years of silence following Matt Stewart's murder, to help investigators regain publicity and traction for this now near-decade-old cold case. At the beginning, I questioned why this case hadn't been covered in the media hardly at all since it first occurred. But shortly after releasing the first episode last summer, the answer to that question became all too clear. I found myself in an uncomfortable spot, receiving multiple angry and intimidating phone calls, asking me to stop the podcast immediately. I was told quite passionately by members of Matt's family that the podcast was reopening old wounds, and that by broadcasting the little-known details of the murder, I was putting myself and Matt's family in significant danger. In August, there was a phone call during which I was instructed to release a family-approved statement announcing the cancellation of the series due to this alleged danger. I tried my best to ask questions as to the source of this danger, but I got no specific response. Nevertheless, I contacted the Mooresville Police Department and asked for verification of this claim, specifically that the lead investigator on Matt's case had informed a member of Matt's family that my podcast was putting them in danger. Ultimately, this claim was not verified, and the investigator in question seemed confused by the notion entirely. Still, all of this pushback gave me serious pause. Truly, it has never been my intention to hurt or upset anyone. So I began to rethink whether or not I should be doing this podcast. Clearly, it sparked local interest in Matt's murder, but with his loved ones being so openly opposed to the idea of bringing attention back to the situation, I wondered if maybe I was wrong in wanting to amplify this story. Maybe it wouldn't bring about new information or closure, and only serve to conjure painful memories. So I sought professional opinion, arguably one of the strongest authorities in the nation on cold case homicides, is Cheryl McCollum. She's a renowned crime scene investigator. In 2004, she created the National Cold Case Investigative Research Institute, which partners with higher learning institutions across the country to connect law enforcement agencies with experts and scholars who volunteer their time to help investigations that, for whatever reason, have gone cold. I wanted to ask Mrs. McCollum about the role media can play in cold case murders.
To me, when you've got a case that 20 years old, 40 years old, without the press, you're talking about new police officers that weren't even born when the case happened. So I think it's incredible that they would be able to listen to a podcast or turn on the news or read in the newspaper about a case that affects their area, their zone, their department. And you might actually have somebody come to you that feels more comfortable talking to you than going to the police. I mean, there's been multiple podcasts that have located witnesses or had somebody come forward and say, hey, I heard you were doing this and the police never interviewed me, but here's what I remember. I mean, those kind of things are, I mean, you can't even put a value on it, in my opinion. So it's really unusual to me to hear you say there's a family that doesn't want it. I would be curious, and I would almost even want to talk to them and say, what can we do to keep the story alive if you don't want media? And I haven't heard your podcast, so I don't know how you're doing it. I don't know how you're phrasing things, so I don't know if they're upset by the delivery or how you're putting the information out. But I'm saying as a general rule that when it comes to cold cases, 90% of the people that I work with, the family members, are desperate for media. And they tell me all the time, nobody remembers, nobody cares. They want their story out. They're desperate to keep it alive.
Conversations like this have helped to solidify my resolve in continuing this series into a second season. Because if there's any chance that press coverage can help this case reach resolution, then Matt deserves as much of it as possible. And if others aren't willing to report on this murder, I will. So with a renewed sense of purpose, I dove in headfirst. Last season, we more or less arrived at the conclusion that Matt Stewart's murder wasn't a random attack or crime of opportunity, but rather targeted and personal. We've heard a lot of interesting testimonies from Matt's friends, family, and neighbors, but clearly, there's a whole lot we aren't seeing. As I thought it over more and more, I began to recall something Matt's pastor, Byron Wicker, mentioned last season.
I spent a lot of time with the police, actually. Okay, because I was sort of there. Because what they told me is Matt had, like, basically three circles of life. He had his work circle, his home family circle, and his church circle. So that's where they would focus at, is those three places. And that was where their investigation was, going through the family, going through the people at work, and going through the church.
After hours and hours of conversations and networking my way through connections of family, friends, and neighbors, there was still an entire piece of Matt's life I was missing. So last fall, I contacted some of Matt's former coworkers to see if any would be willing to chat. A few agreed, namely, a woman who claims to have been Matt's supervisor at the hospital, Amanda Collier.
I know you said you met him in 1999.
Well, I started in 99. I don't know if I met him until a year or so later when he started working.
Do you remember, like, first impressions of Matt?
I think one of the first times I ever worked with him, I was working pediatrics, and he was the aide on pediatrics. And he was just a fun, attentive guy who would... We made fun of Matt because he would always turn a ball game on in one of the patient's rooms that was empty. So so he could stay up to date with whatever ball game was on. But he did his job, and he was great with his patients. And I remember he would do anything for anyone. Like, he was great with the patients. He was fun with them. They all loved him. He was a fun guy.
I've heard a lot about the antics.
Yeah, he was a huge practical joker. He loved to play practical jokes. He didn't like them being played on him.
Isn't that just like somebody who likes playing practical jokes? Did not like that being played on him.
He would take the medical tape, and if you were in a room, he would take it and, like, tape it across the door. So when you open the door to walk out, you would walk through this wall of tape. That was fun.
Were you ever a victim of one of those jokes?
See, the tape one a couple times. The alcohol foam down the back of your throat. I think the funniest one was played on him was by one of the other nurses, Joni. She took his keys and moved his truck in the parking lot. So when he left that night, he couldn't find his truck. He didn't like people playing jokes on him, but it was hilarious. Because she didn't do anything with it other than move it like five spaces away.
You're the first one I talked with on the phone that actually worked with Matt. And I've gotten to explore a lot of other parts of his life, but have not really gotten a good sense of what his work environment was like. I mean, was it a close-knit group?
Mooresville was small enough, or is small enough, that there's that hometown feel. That the patients you know are from your community. You know them. You know their families. They know you. It was close-knit, and so you had to have that friendship and teamwork to stay there.
There's a lot of camaraderie, it sounds like. You're working with people you know. Was there, like, was he part of a particular shift, or did that kind of fluctuate?
Well, when he was a CNA, he worked mid-shift, so, like, 3 to 11, 3 p.m. to 11 p.m., because he was in school, so he'd go to classes and then come to work. Once he became a registered nurse, he worked day shift, 7 a.m. to 7 p.m.
Did the nurses get together outside of work, or did you kind of know a lot about each other's social lives? Or?
Well, when you work with people 12 hours a day, you know them even if you don't hang out with them after work. And Matt wasn't one to socialize with people after work. He went home to his family. There was a few of us who would go, you know, we'd go out and celebrate someone's birthday, but Matt usually didn't do stuff with us.
Yeah, because he had the kids at home.
Right.
Gotcha. He was a family guy.
Yeah, he was a family guy.
So I know you had said before that you were one of the managing nurses, so you could say oversaw him, or you were kind of one of his superiors. Was that true until he passed away in 2009?
Yes, when I was actually the clinical nurse manager for night shift in that department he worked in, and I was working the night that he died.
Did he work the night shift at all? Or?
Well, he would occasionally help out and stay till like 11, but I don't think he ever worked overnight.
Okay.
He worked a lot. We typically work 3 days a week, 12-hour shifts, so that's full time for us. But he typically worked 4 and 5 days a week, because I don't think, I knew Angel was a nurse as well. She worked downtown in Charlotte, but I don't know if she worked full time or part time, but I knew Matt worked a lot.
So Matt worked more than typical is what you're saying in your perspective.
And he was, and you know, when I work that many hours, yeah, I get grumpy. He never got grumpy. He was a happy guy. He was happy to do his job. He found humor in everything.
Why do you think, was it that he was new and he had to kind of earn his time by working a lot, or was that something you think he chose to do?
He wanted the overtime. He wanted to do it. You know, you get time and a half. You get bonuses for working overtime. I don't know if he did it, you know, to pay for the private school for his kids, or I never asked. If he wanted an extra shift and we needed it, I got it.
Did he ever get the sense that he was struggling financially or anything like that? I mean, did he ever talk about that?
No. But, you know, that's not something people always talk about.
That's true.
Our culture, our society, you don't talk about the difficulties you're having. No, I never got any sense that he was struggling. So there were plenty of people who worked overtime, you know, to pay for the extras.
He wasn't the only one doing it.
No.
Did he ever talk about his personal life with you or with other nurses? Or,
you know, as a group. He talked about his kids. He was dedicated to his kids. He was excited to be a father, and he enjoyed being a father.
Did you ever get the sense that there was anything, any kind of problems or anything?
No. What I remember about Matt was he loved being a dad. He was a big kid himself,
mm-hmm.
you know, with the practical jokes. And he was an upbeat guy, and he liked to horse around and play. You know, you have your really strong nurses who you just love working with them because they do their job, they're helpful, their patients are happy. And then you have those that are there, you know, kind of floating along. They do their job, but they don't go above and beyond. And Matt sort of fell in between those two. He wasn't the strongest nurse. He hadn't been a nurse very long, but he was fun to work with. And he was very helpful. You know, if anybody needed anything, you know, he was willing to come in and help, you know, get your patient up out of bed with you or walk them or whatever you needed when it took more than one person.
So yeah. he wasn't like a climber or anything. He wasn't like...
He never acted like he wanted to be a charge nurse or a nursing supervisor or work his way into anything else. He enjoyed coming in and taking care of the patients he had and leaving them. When his shift was over, he left them. He had no responsibilities there after he left. He was that nurse who was, our shifts were over at 7:15, and he was out the door at 7:15 every day. His job was done, and he wanted to get home.
Do you remember seeing him that day?
Yeah.
You do?
Yeah.
What do you remember about that?
Nothing other than, you know, saying goodnight to him. And what I would do is when people would leave their shift, I would make sure I knew where they worked, what assignment they had that day. So the next morning when it was time to make the staffing sheets for the next morning, I could put the nurses who were there the day before back in their same assignment. So, you know, other than just saying, you know, goodnight and making sure I knew where he worked, which was the 217 hallway. I remember it.
That night he was working the 217 hallway.
Yeah.
You and you had said before that exchange probably would have happened at 7, you say 7:15, 7:30?
It's between 7 and 7:30. Because I usually got there between 6:30 and 6:45.
So it was just a matter of hours. You don't remember him. Did it seem like he was acting differently or there was something on his mind? Obviously, I know this is a decade ago.
Like, I remember thinking on it when it happened. Was there anything going on? And no, he was in his usual spirit. Some of us would wait and we would all leave together as a group, depending on who you worked with that night. Matt was never that person. He didn't wait for anyone. He was ready to go. And he was like that every shift. But no, he was not in any different mood. His work wasn't unfocused. From what I recall, like he had his book bag on his shoulder like he always did, good jovial mood, saying goodnight to everybody. He would high-five people. That was his thing. And that was it. He was gone. He said goodnight and was out the door.
So you were at the hospital then when this happened. Did you get the news while you were at the hospital?
Yes, I was working. I had to break it to the staff. I had to mark him off the schedule. And I had to call the other manager so they could come in early. And I also called the director of nursing to let her know. Because they all came in to be there.
Wow.
So we should tell them. A few of the nurses who worked in our department actually went to high school with Matt and knew him very well. know, been known him since childhood. Nurse who was doing house supervision that night came and told me. She told me what she knew, which was, you know, at that point very little. We just knew he was dead from a home invasion. Everyone from the physicians that worked on our floor to the nursing staff to the housekeepers to everyone who interacted with Matt was really devastated. It was shocking, and I think I was in shock for a while. Mm-hmm. And I remember going to his wake at Cabin Cook in Mooresville, and then his funeral the next day. And I don't think we really, as a group, collectively grieved. I think everyone did it on their own. We had to make it through.
I mean, was there ever a fear that, you know, is it someone at work? Is it someone, am I in any danger? Did that ever cross
your mind? I never thought about that, but I remember other people speculating. Like, what if it was a disgruntled patient or a patient's family? Something like that. But I can't remember Matt being ever involved with, you know, a complaint by a patient that was enough that, like, we had to move him off that patient assignment or anything like that.
He didn't have anyone, to your knowledge, at work that had a problem with him?
No. No. I can't think of anyone who didn't like working with Matt. Nope, can't think of anyone.
Out of the dozens of people I've interviewed, this response is one I've grown accustomed to hearing. The idea that anyone would wish harm on Matt Stewart remains downright befuddling. Last season, in the second episode, I spoke with a woman named Melissa, who lived down the street from the Stewarts at the time of Matt's murder, the one who said she heard her dog barking at the woods in the backyard. In that episode, I included portions of my first conversation with her, but what I failed to mention was that minutes after that call was over, she called me back.
So you said that you talked with your husband and something came up, he remembered something?
I was telling him that you and I were talking about, and he asked me if I remembered any motives for Matt being killed. And I told him that I don't recall any. He goes, yeah, there was the one motive, remember? I was like, no. He's like, the one about him selling drugs from the hospital? I was like, oh, yeah, I do remember that now.
Wait.
There was a rumor going around that Matt had been selling drugs from the hospital. He had stepped on somebody's toes. Now, no telling what kind of truth there was to that, but there was a rumor going around about that.
Does your husband recall that rumor being around before Matt was killed? Or
After.
Wow.
Right.
And does he remember where he heard that?
He does not.
I didn't initially include this for a good reason. You heard Melissa herself admit that this is just hearsay. And to those who knew him, the idea that Matt would have been involved in anything nefarious around the time of his murder is nothing short of ridiculous. Sure, Matt's young adult life wasn't exactly leave it to Beaver wholesome, but neither was mine, or probably yours. He dabbled in drugs as teens typically do, but according to everyone I spoke with that knew him, he turned it all around definitively, took on adult responsibility, and grew to become a man that so many around him respected. The idea that this stuff had anything to do with the life he was leading in 2009 is hard to consider. Still, the rumor that Melissa referenced, that Matt had sold drugs out of Lake Norman Hospital, would have been a lot easier to ignore had she been the only one who had mentioned hearing it. Over the last year, it surfaced time and again, albeit from sources who were admittedly not close to Matt. Even so, I saw my conversation with Matt's supervisor, Amanda, as a great opportunity to address this nagging rumor.
I remember they pulled his med administration and somebody poured over that to make sure, you know, patients were given what was pulled from the, and everything was given. There was no stealing of drugs from the unit, anything like that going on.
In your experience, you know, what would his availability have been, even if he wanted to do that?
Well, we had a system where every medication you pulled from the, we had an Accudose. Every medication you pulled from there, you had to scan as you gave it to the patient. You had to scan the patient, and you had to scan the medication. And anything we didn't give that was narcotic-wise, you have to waste with another nurse. You have to have a witness that you're disposing of it appropriately. In my 20 years as a nurse, I mean, there have been nurses who have diverted narcotics, but they get caught. It's hard, the systems we have in place. But yes, somebody went over his narcotic pulls. I don't know if like pharmacy and risk management did. That seems like they would be the ones who would do it.
Basically, what you heard was that it came back that you had a spotless.
We did reports monthly on how well nurses were scanning their medications that they pulled and whether they were. I mean, you can, of course, like go in and manually enter into the computer that you gave a medication. But we get a report that you did it, and we need to find out why you did it. And Matt worked so much that he had quite a few pulls, but he was also the one who had the highest scan rate. You know, we wanted everyone to be 97% or above, and he was always there. He scanned his medication. So I remember that about him because we would always point it out, like,
yeah.
You know, Matt worked 60 hours a week, and he can get a 98% scan rate. Why can't the rest of the nurses do this?
So, okay. That would be notable then.
There was never any question about him.
According to Amanda, the idea that Matt was up to anything at the hospital other than helping people and occasionally pulling lighthearted pranks is far-fetched. After nearly a year of relentless digging, I constantly find myself wondering if I'm any closer to learning the truth than the day I started. However, there may be reason to believe that some of those closest to Matt know a hell of a lot more about the investigation into his murder than I do.
Yo, what's up?
How you doing?
Is now a good time to talk?
Yeah, sure.
So I just talked to the mother-in-law over the phone.
How'd the call come up? Did she just call you out of nowhere?
I called her. I called her back after she had called two or three times, and then she eventually left that voicemail. I mean, basically, after this conversation, I'm left with the impression that she knows who committed the murder.
Well, she's got to have a theory, right? You can't be that close to the situation and not at least suspect something, right?
I mean, it was the same thing as the time I talked to her before. I'm putting the family through this awful thing. I'm reopening old wounds. She said he's alive and well. And you better watch your back.
Who? The person who killed Matt?
Yeah, the murderer.
She said that he's alive and well.
She said he's alive and well. That's a
verbatim quote. Did she mean it's like a threat or?
Like, yeah, I mean, yeah, that's what I took it as.
So that implies that she knows exactly who did this and that it's a him.
They were saying before, like, I'm putting them in danger. And I brought that up to say that, well, you know, if this person is still out there, then, you know, they're still a threat to the community. And she said, no, it's not us that's in danger. This person is alive and well, and you better watch your back.
So do you think she was just trying to scare you off, or that she really does know?
I don't know. I don't know what to make of it.
Whether she actually knows or not, she just told you that she knows who did it, right?
More or less, yeah.
That's a lead that has to be passed on to the police. Even if she won't tell you the name, if she's saying she knows who did it and that they're still alive, that's something that the police need to know. Are you going to put this on the podcast?
I don't know how I wouldn't put it, because I told everyone, like, I'm going to go out there and interview people, and I'm going to talk about this, and we're going to see what we can find. and then I get a call from the mother-in-law. And how am I not? Like, why would she tell me that as a podcaster if she doesn't think that I'm going to have to say that to the audience?
Right.
Like, how do I not say that when I'm the only one, for whatever fucking reason, that is looking at this murder, that is willing to talk about it and publish something about it? And then you're someone close to the victim, and you're going to tell me to watch my back, and you're going to tell me that the murderer is alive and well. Like, how am I supposed to take that?
Yeah, I mean, you have to take it as a threat, and I think you have to report it.
Yeah, but they're not going to give a... I mean, they've worked so hard to bury this thing.
Who's they? The family or police?
Both. I don't even think they'll pretend to care.
No, but at least you'll have it documented that you reported it. Whatever she might know, I suspect the police know that also. Now, why they haven't acted on it or can't act on it, I have no idea. But
or won't act on it.
Or won't act on it.
I don't know. This is the creepiest thing that's ever happened to me.
Yeah, obviously.
Next month, we'll take a trip back to Mooresville and venture into the Gabriel Estates neighborhood, where we'll speak with more neighbors about their experiences in the hours and days after the murder. Unforgotten is a Bold Era production, written and recorded by myself, Freddie Wilson, in the always sunny Daytona Beach, Florida. A special thanks to Cheryl McCollum, Amanda Collier, and Melissa Champion for their contributions to this episode. As always, this series is dedicated to the life of Matt Stewart. May his memory remain unforgotten. If you have any suggestions about topics or questions to be included in future special episodes, you can submit them on the forum located at unforgotten.freeforums.net.